think we left off talking about the 13 colonies and what was happening there, now known as the United States of America. Mentioned that the population was white and primarily from the British Isles, mostly English, some Scotch-Irish. And from the beginning, there were gathered churches rather than state churches. This was a fundamental difference from Europe. And it characterized the whole movement here in what became the United States. You had Baptist churches beginning to be founded. Roger Williams founded a Baptist church in Providence, and founded Providence for complete religious liberty. And the kind of Protestantism that was common in the States here was radical. It wasn't the conservative state church type. And it tended to be a reformed Protestantism, largely Calvinistic. And although there were strongly religious beginnings, this is an interesting thing. By 1750, only 5% were church members. Only 5% of the people in the colonies by 1750 were church members. So you can see that, and then of course all of those weren't really believers. So that you realize that came along not for religious reasons, for economic reasons. A lot of them were poor, and they came from state church backgrounds, and they had no real convictions, and when they got over here in the frontier and they were trying to get established, they just forgot church and went their own way. So that you have here an area, largely a non-church-going population. And it was into this situation that the Great Awakening came, as it's called. And we want to look at that in particular. Because the churches in the colonies were what we speak of as gathered churches, you weren't just simply born into them, you weren't baptized as babies and brought into them. It was because of personal, individual conversion. Because of this, there was a stress on evangelism. And revivals were common. And those that were really Christians had a real concern for the lost. They said, here are all these people around us, and they're lost. Because they didn't even have the shell of church membership, as they would have had in, say, Europe, being part of the state church. Now, there was a difference in the Calvinism. Traditional Calvinism said that Christianity consisted of this. Number one, correct doctrine. Secondly, a worthy life. You should live a good life, a moral life. And you should be faithful in attendance at the sacraments. If you did this, you were, quote, Christian. Now, in New England, the New England Calvinism had a different emphasis in that they said, yes, you need correct doctrine, you need a worthy life, but you need an experience of salvation. There was a stress on this thing. You must have a personal crisis experience when you receive Christ. Whereas in Europe, the stress was more on the sacraments. You're baptized in the church, you go through confirmation, this type of thing, and just kind of fit into the established church. So that you have an emphasis on this crisis type of salvation right from the beginning. Now, the Great Awakening, I suppose you could say, began in 1720 when there was a man by the name of Frelinghuysen. That's quite a name. Frelinghuysen. He was the pastor of a Dutch Reformed church in New Jersey. And he really began preaching strongly the need for the new birth, a changed life. And this really affected many people. People were getting saved. People were turning to the Lord. Another man by the name of Gilbert Tennant, a Presbyterian minister, caught this fire. He got stirred up by this message. He began preaching this. Wasn't enough just to be baptized and go to church and this kind of thing. Have you been born again? Have you experienced new life? Are you a new creature in Christ? See, this was the stress. And so the revival spread through the Scotch-Irish, through Gilbert Tennant's preaching and some others. And then quite a famous name, Jonathan Edwards. Jonathan Edwards, his dates, 1703 to 1758. He was a brilliant man. He was very devotional, sort of mystical in his thinking and in his beliefs. So he wasn't just a cold theoretical theologian. He emphasized this personal, warm relationship with the Lord. He was a Yale graduate. Yale was quite small and new, but he was a graduate of Yale. He became the pastor of a congregational church in Northampton, Massachusetts. They say that his style of delivery was kind of slow. He spoke slowly. He spoke solemnly. And he preached against sin. He must have been like the story is told of Calvin Coolidge. He went to hear a man preach, and when he came home, his wife said, "What did he preach on?" Coolidge said, "Sin." "What did he say about it?" his wife said. And the story goes, Coolidge said, "He was against it." Well, Jonathan Edwards is against sin. And he preached strongly against sin. One of his famous sermons, "Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God." And the tremendous stress here on judgment, on hell. And during the winter and spring of 1734 and 35, there was a wave of conviction in that area, and hundreds turned to Christ. There was quite a movement of the Spirit of God. This was with Jonathan Edwards. Now, another name in connection with this we should notice is that of George Whitefield. 1714 to 1770. One of the greatest preachers of that age. George Whitefield. He was born at Gloucester, England. And he wasn't brought up in good circumstances. His family was poor. His father was an innkeeper and just a poor man, just a struggle to make ends meet and to survive. He entered Oxford in 1733, and there he got acquainted with the Wesleys and closely associated with them. And it was during this period of time, too, that he went through a period of real conviction, terrible conviction of sin, and he came to faith and peace with God. It was a very real experience for him. He didn't just kind of slide into his religion. It was a very much of a crisis time when he was convicted of sin and troubled about sin and turned to the Lord. Now, he was a great preacher, powerful, a tremendous voice. I suppose in his day there was no one with a stronger voice. He was dramatic. He was expressive. He spoke in a very moving way. He could sway people. They say that even Ben Franklin was moved with emotion as he heard Whitefield speak. Maybe he could have said, "Almost thou persuadest me to be a Christian." But he was deeply moved. And Benjamin Franklin was a deist, and he wasn't for this emotional type religion or that. But Whitefield's preaching was very, very powerful. Tremendous volume, too. He came over to the colonies and preached from 1739 to 41. This was one of his preaching tours. He made others. In all, he made 6 visits to America. And he did preaching in various places. At one time, 30,000 gathered in the Boston Commons to hear him. 30,000. And they could all hear him, apparently. He had a powerful voice. Built-in PA system. because he could really turn up the volume. Now, this awakening began to spread through the colonies, largely through the Congregationalists and Presbyterians. And there were some emotional excesses. There were accounts where people would fall into trances and into hysteria and begin screaming and rolling on the floor and this type of thing. And some preachers, depending on the preacher, encouraged it. Some preachers were after the emotional response and others were not so much. It just depended a lot on the individual preacher, but there was some of this that accompanied. And through this period of time, you have the Baptists now really taking hold and beginning to spread very rapidly. They stressed, you remember, personal conversion followed by baptism. And they spread very, very rapidly. Another thing that encouraged their spread was that both the Baptists and Methodists, maybe we'll touch on this a little further, emphasized lay preachers and the fact that you didn't have to have a theological education to be a preacher. So that this was very helpful in a rapidly expanding situation. They could move rapidly. They didn't have to say to a young man, well, now you go to seminary and then after 6 or 8 years you come back and then we'll let you preach. If a fellow really came to know the Lord and was studying the Word and showed some gift in preaching right away, they'd say, well, go to it, you know, and he'd get the preaching in different churches around. And this encouraged the spread of the movement. Whereas you have churches like the Church of England and those that required a more formally educated ministry that simply didn't have the personnel to move. They were all tied up. Their ministers are preaching at their established churches and they couldn't expand rapidly and didn't. So there was a large increase in the Christian population during this time. And the Calvinism that first came over with the Presbyterians and with the Congregationalists was modified in the preaching. During the Great Awakening, they simply didn't believe in a limited atonement. And they weren't preaching irresistible grace. There was more stress here on the fact that Christ loves all and died for all and salvation is available to all. Will you accept Christ? The stress being laid on human free will. And yet along with this, of course, an emphasis in many of these areas that if you once received Christ, you are saved, and there was a stress on security of the believer by these who had a modified Calvinism. So man's free will was given more of a place, and there was this appeal to the will. It wasn't simply, well, you know, if you're not one of the elect, you can't be saved, sort of thing. But here there was this stress, yes, God loves you, and Christ died for you, and you can be saved. You receive Christ. A very strong stress on evangelism. And through this period of time, too, there were missions to the Indians. One of the first to be interested in the Indians was a man named John Eliot, E-L-I-O-T, and he came to America in 1631, preached to Indians, translated the Bible for them. So there were these who came over who were concerned for the lost Indians around them, for these tribes that they were just beginning to contact. Roger Williams also had a concern for Indians, and there were others. The desire to bring the gospel to them. During the Great Awakening, too, you have Negroes being touched. There's quite a movement here. Of course, slaves being brought over. And quite a population of Negroes in certain areas. And the among the blacks here, many were being saved. And the time of the awakening was very critical, I really feel, as to the effect that it had upon our nation in its formative years here. Because in 1776 there was a Declaration of Independence, you know, the Revolutionary War. Now this is before this. This is building up to this, the awakening, you see, about the middle of the period here. 1750 and in through there. So that here you have a strong awakening, you have Christians really concerned to preach the gospel, you have people being saved, you have an emphasis of preaching against sin. These were concepts, you see, that were floating around. And Christians, even though they were a minority, were having an influence on society and had an influence as this country was being formed. There was much preaching against immorality and profanity and drunkenness and gambling, all of these vices and sins. The Christians were starting schools and universities. You go back to the beginnings of the Ivy League schools in our country, for example, and their church schools, basically, started by Christians in the beginning. Many of them now have nothing to do with Christianity, but this was their beginning. There was a concern, even starting then, for fairness in treating the Indians and their treatment of Indians and the blacks. And some even now beginning to feel concern about black slavery. And of course this began to snowball and build in the years that lay ahead. And as our Constitution was framed, there was a strong emphasis on the fact that this preaching, this revival, this awakening was emphasizing very strongly through the gospel, you see, the value of man, the dignity of man, man's made in the image of God, and all of these ideas had an impact in the early days of our country. So even though Christians were a minority, they were a very vocal, aggressive minority, and the Lord was working during this period of time. And I believe it really had perhaps a greater impact on our country and its ideals and laws as they were framed in those early days, a greater impact than we maybe realize today. Even among those, you see, that were not real Christians, yet this preaching, this environment, it was molding their thinking and it was affecting them. Now, during this time, there was, as we think of the intellectual development, there was a progressive de-Christianization in certain areas. Now, what do you think were some of the things happening during this period that really were undermining Christian concepts? What did you say would...
Wasn't rationalism not in?
Yes, that would be coming in very shortly.
I know in Finney's book, any time or is that later?
Finney. Well, he's a little later.
Book Revival Fire, there was a real stress on emotionalism.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, among these things, one of the things I'd like to mention is the scientific discoveries. Many people were beginning to think, well, maybe Christianity's been wrong, especially when the church has advocated certain ideas that weren't right. The Copernican theory, for example. Before this, the teaching was that what was the center of the universe? The earth was the center. The sun revolved around the earth. Well, when we have this theory coming in now, and seeming to have good support, that actually the earth isn't the center. And the earth just revolves around the sun. why there seemed to be a real conflict there, especially when the Roman Catholic Church opposes very strongly. And people said, well, maybe Christianity's all wrong. Church is opposing this. Here's science. Here you're having this conflict now of science and Christianity. Supposedly arising. And you have various philosophers coming along who begin to introduce doubt. Before this, you remember the great philosophers were also theologians. Whether it's Anselm or Aquinas, or whoever you may name during the Middle Ages, basically here, their philosophy was in a theological framework. But now you're beginning to have men come along who introduce a system of thought that's removed from Christianity. You have René Descartes. His date's 1596 to 1650. And he sometimes is called the father of modern philosophy. His approach is, you doubt, you question. This is the way you learn. So you doubt everything. Everything must be proved. Now this basic idea led many to doubt God. How can you prove God? Well, if you can't prove God, you reject God. You have a man coming along, Spinoza, and his date 1632 to 1677. He was Jewish from Amsterdam. He became a pantheist. God equals nature. And there's no room left for creation. There's no room left for miracles. So you have this as part of the philosophic background. You have John Locke. And although he's a professing Christian himself, some of his writings, especially wrote an essay concerning human understanding that led many to doubt and to question and to complete skepticism. So you see here a whole building of philosophy that really is leaving God out, leaving the special revelation out. Thomas Hobbes came along, 1588 to 1679. 1588 to 1679, and he was a materialist. He says only matter exists. God and all the rest. Forget it. And then there's one, another man we will mention here, perhaps not as familiar, but he's important because of a line of thought that flows from him, Edward Herbert. His date 1583 to 1648. And he sort of laid the foundations of deism. And we run into deism a lot. It was very popular in intellectual circles during this period of time. And in the early days here of the United States, among the intellectuals. A very, very popular way of thinking. And some of the basic concepts of deism are that religion can be known naturally without special revelation. Every man can come to know God. What can he know about God? Well, he can know there is a God. There's one supreme creator, and he should be worshipped. And every man knows he should live a good life. And every man has a sense of judgment. Ultimately, when I die, I'm going to be judged before God for my good and for my bad. And there will be reward or punishment. So that these are concepts, he said, that people have everywhere. And that this is true. This is true religion. Now you see, this leaves Christianity out, basically. The special character of Christianity, special revelation, this is not needed and simply isn't true. Now, deism developed further and emphasized that all religion must be subject to reason. So if I can't understand a thing, if I can't reason through a thing, I discard it, I reject it. Now, I can't understand miracles. I can't really accept the incarnation, naturally speaking. Therefore, I reject it. I only accept what I can rationally see and prove and test. You see, it's going along with this rationalism and this skepticism that's beginning to develop. And the idea here that God is aloof and he's removed. There is a God, but he's way off there somewhere. And here we are, and he set up this system of creation, and it's functioning now according to natural laws, and he's not concerned, and he's certainly not going to interfere. There are no miracles. You see the sun come up every morning. You see natural laws. Spring is coming now. And these are things that happen year in and year out. God does not interfere. He started it all, but he's not actively involved in creation. You see, there's a very different idea in the Bible, in Judaism and in Christianity, in that God did not only create, but he's very actively involved. Remember what he says in Hebrews? He upholds all things by the word of his power. Paul could say, in him we live and move and have our being. In Acts 17. So you see, there's a very different concept here. Deism removes God. God is far away. And also, there was a kind of an optimism here. Man is really basically good. And he's rational. And he can work things out. And we're going to figure things out. And things are going to get better. There isn't this concept that man is basically depraved like you have in John Calvin's writing. So you can see a very different outlook. And really today, when you get down to talking to many people, you'd say they're pretty much deists. They wouldn't know it, but they'll say, oh, I believe in God. But he's way off there somewhere, and I'm not sure, you know, if you can even get to know him. And the creation functions according to natural law. There are no miracles or anything like this. And if you do good, you've got a conscience, you do what's right, you live up to your conscience, and then in the end, if there's a judgment or whatever, you'll be all right. Deistic concept. Now, during this period of time, you did have, I just would like to touch briefly on art and music. During the Middle Ages, religious themes were dominant, weren't they? If you look at paintings, you know, during the Middle Ages, paintings of the Madonna, paintings of the Christ child, paintings of the Assumption of Mary, or whatever, they're religious themes. Now, during this period, you begin moving away from that increasingly. Although you have some great works completed during this period, Leonardo da Vinci, in 1498, completed the Last Supper. And during the 1500s, you have Raphael and Michelangelo with those famous works of art. In Italy. During this period, you have the construction of St. Peter's in Rome. And then during this period, you have Johann Sebastian Bach, 1685 to 1750. He was a Lutheran, and he gave his life to music, and certainly centered, you know, in Christian themes. Some beautiful music by Bach. And then you have, during this period of time too, George Frideric Handel, 1685 to 1759. He's a contemporary of Bach, isn't he? Lives 9 years longer, and of course we think of him, we think of which piece of music? The Messiah. Alright. So, during this period of time, although you didn't have uniformly religious themes. You had a lot that were writing in their literature and their artwork and music and so forth, taking off in other areas, leaving Christianity in the background completely. But you do have some great works here that were made during this period. Well, why don't we leave that period? We've been there quite a while, but it's such an important period during the Reformation and then moving up to 1750 that we spent quite a bit of time on it. Now we get into this section that Lateret calls Repudiation and Revival. 1750 to 1815. And it's not a lengthy period of time, but it is important. And we want to move along through it. A growing repudiation of Christianity by growing elements within Christianity. See, during the Middle Ages, intellectually, there wasn't much questioning going on, or if there was any, you were very quiet about it. It just wasn't healthy to be very outspoken about your doubts. But increasingly, especially in Europe, there are elements of the population that are questioning. No longer just accepting these things because the church says them, but questioning and turning away from the truths of Christianity. Let's think of some of these adverse factors, these movements against Christianity. And first of all, we think of how Roman Catholicism was affected, because it knew some real losses. First of all, I think you could say that one of the reasons for the decline of the power of Rome was that two of the strongest Roman Catholic countries began to decline. Spain and Portugal. They just began to lose steam as world powers. You remember Spain was really in the forefront of extending Roman Catholicism through Latin America, the Philippines, Central America, Mexico, up into the south, into Texas, New Mexico of the United States, and into California. Very, very active. Now, during this period of time, Spain and Portugal declined. Part of this was because Napoleon's armies overran Spain, and she just gradually was losing control of her colonies. Now, there was a little advance in California during this period. From 1750 to 1800, in 50 years, there were 18 missions opened up in California, going up the coast of California. If you are ever there, and visit some of these areas, you'll notice one of the tourist attractions in each section there that you go to, especially in Southern California, will be the missions. And they're very interesting to see, to visit. It was during this period of time, 1750 to 1800, that they were fighting to keep their hold there. The Franciscans were moving up the coast. And there were some new missions in Texas, but as a whole, the picture was black as far as Rome was concerned, and Spain losing control gradually over its possessions. Something else that really hit Rome was the Jesuits came under attack. It wasn't popular during this period to be a Jesuit. There's a lot of jealousy by the other orders. The Jesuits were very disciplined. They were very strong. They could be ruthless. Too often, perhaps, their philosophy was the end justifies the means. And some of these other orders were really getting fed up with it. There was a lot of jealousy anyway between the Franciscans and Dominicans and Augustinians and the Jesuits. And this thing builds up now. So that pressure is being put on the Jesuits. In 1759, Portugal expelled the Jesuits from Portugal and their possessions. All the Jesuits get out. And in 1764, 5 years later, France expelled them. In 1767, Spain and Naples expelled them. So the Jesuits are running. They're being expelled by these nations. And finally, the Pope is under so much pressure in 1773 that he dissolved the order. He just said it no longer exists. Well, some of the Jesuits didn't give up that easily. Some of them hid out in Russia and Prussia and other parts of Europe and just kind of went underground. They sometimes used different names, but they were hanging on and hoping one way or another we will overcome, I guess. But during this period, it was a black time for the Jesuits. And because of this, because they were in the forefront, and they were doing so much missionary work in a lot of these areas, it just meant that some of the missionary work collapsed for Rome in these different parts. And even though the properties and work would be transferred to another order, sometimes they didn't have the leadership or the personnel to man it, and there was a confusion of changing over, and as a result, missionary work really kind of ground to a halt in many areas. And there was damage done that the work never recovered from, as far as Rome was concerned, in doing missionary work during this period. So in 1814, the Pope reinstituted them as an order. They did come back in 1814, but the damage was done. They'd lost a lot of territory. And before this time, the Jesuits were in the forefront. They were the leaders in so much of the missionary work. So this is one of the adverse factors as far as Rome was concerned. Now, certain countries became sealed off to Christianity, thinking of the missionary work. Japan closed the doors and began to persecute Christianity and didn't allow any missionary activity. You couldn't be a missionary, couldn't be a Christian openly in Japan. In China, too, you have a turning now. And Christians being persecuted in China. Something else that hit Christianity was Freemasonry spreading over from England to the continent. When you think of the Masons, I don't know if we have any here or not, but anyway, I doubt that we do. What do you think of in connection with the Masons? Maybe don't know that much about them. Well, yes, it became a secret organization with a certain philosophy, certain outlook, a certain posture. And at this time, it was very anti-Roman Catholic and has traditionally been this. Christy? Yes. Traditionally, it has been anti-Roman Catholic. So it spread over into Europe, and it was deistic also. Now, to be a Mason, you don't have to be a Christian. You have to believe in one God. Some of these concepts, you see, that deism holds to. But for some people, this became their religion. In fact, I remember some years back getting a ride with a man, and he told me very frankly, I witnessed to him in the car, he was going up in the mountains in Southern California, and as I witnessed to him about the Lord, he says, I don't need the church, he says, I'm a Mason. And he told me, I don't know which degree he was, 32nd degree or 33rd degree or whatever. But anyway, he said, this is my church. He says, I believe in God. I believe in doing good. You know all the good we do. See? So some of this philosophy now, as it came in, wasn't a help to real Christianity on the continent. The 18th century is called the Age of Reason. This affected Christianity. The various philosophers we've noticed already, expressing doubt, questioning, and the feeling increasingly that we're emancipated from superstition. And there was superstition in, especially, a lot of Roman Catholicism, the worship of relics and going on pilgrimages and the shrines and stories about the supernatural miracles taking place and things like this. Well, a lot of thinking people said, oh, it's just all superstition. And they threw the baby out with the bathwater. They said, well, because there's superstition in connection with some of the religion, therefore Christianity outlived. Now, this expressed itself in deism, religiously. We've already touched on deism. It's a natural religion. There was an emphasis, you don't need the Bible. The Bible is just a human book. And the Bible is going to come under increasing attack here, we'll notice. There is a God. He's the supreme creator. We should worship him. And the best way to serve God is live a good life. You want to serve God? Live a good life. You'll be judged for how you live. No miracle. This world's a closed system. And God is out there somewhere doing his thing, but he's left this world here functioning under natural laws. He's not intervening. Don't believe in miracles. God doesn't stop the sun. He doesn't cause the sea to open up. He doesn't interfere with sickness. God isn't doing anything in this system today. A man who had quite an influence during this time is Voltaire. 1694 to 1778, a very clever man, very daring in some of the things he would write, very critical of Christianity. He was the most read author, it is said, of this period. He was sort of like Erasmus. Erasmus was widely read. He had a clever pen. And Erasmus, too, liked to kind of lampoon the abuses of Christianity. Erasmus never turned against Christianity, but Voltaire did and had a great influence. You have David Hume during this period, 1711 to 1776, and he has an impact on thinking. He is very thorough in his skepticism. You doubt everything. People come to you and they say, well, this is what God says, or this is what the Bible says. Doubt everything. There's no proof for God, is there? And he didn't even believe in deism. He said the whole thing is ridiculous. There's no God. There are no miracles. And as far as ethics go, if they're workable, it's kind of a pragmatic approach. Why, then it's okay. But none of this, because the Bible says, you've got to do something. That's all. And you have now this rationalism and deism affecting churches. Some real losses here. There were churches in England that became Unitarian during this period of time. A number of Presbyterian churches, some Baptist churches, some Church of England men are affected. You have German theologians. We're going to notice this some more. Because German teachers had a great influence not only on Europe in years to come, but here in this country. And you have German theologians accepting deism. And beginning to move in this direction, away from supernatural revelation, special revelation. So that here you're beginning now to see the roots of this that's going to develop further. There's also a current of thought we speak of as Romanticism. Rousseau was a popular writer in this area. And here there could often be a warm, deep feeling, a religious feeling. But often sort of a pantheistic mysticism. You know? You go outside, it's a beautiful spring day, and you see the clouds, and the grass is green, and the trees are budding, and you say, wow, I feel one with nature. God is nature. And I want to commune with nature, commune with God, feel near to God. Climb up on a mountain, feel near to God. Kind of soak in creation through my pores, you know? Which is all very nice and warm and seems so good, so nice, and so rational. But can leave God and special revelation and Christianity completely out, which is what many did. Something else that kind of set back for the time being the advance of Christianity was the revolution of the colonies. This disrupted life, any revolution does, and religion, it was kind of a setback. And also many of the leaders of the revolution were deists, and many of those that were the founding fathers of the United States were deists. Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, openly deists. You have during this period of time, Thomas Paine writing. He lived from 1737 to 1809, and he wrote The Age of Reason. Thomas Paine influenced many people in the United States. And he opposed Christianity. He was a deist. Thomas Paine. So that these were things that affected Christianity in the United States.